This is episode Foxtrot of the Software Freedom Law Show. Hi, and welcome to another show. I'm pretty excited about this show because I think that the best part about doing this podcast is knowing that we have listeners that care about this material enough, actually, that they've been asking us questions.
Yeah, it's good that I don't have to use just the download statistics anymore, which are probably misleading, to figure out if we have listeners. We've been getting email questions enough such that we've been able to collect a bunch and devote an entire show just to answering listener questions.
We've gotten them by email. I've actually gotten some in person, but I don't remember what they were because they were in person.
Yeah, I wish we had. I wish we had the David Letterman song, the old one that Paul used to play for Viewer Mail. It's Viewer Mail. You know that one?
Nope.
Yeah, it's probably copyright infringement.
I'll have to follow our link in the show notes and figure out what it is later.
Thing is, if we played it, it would probably be copyright infringement. And plus, it was from the time when he was on the other network.
Depending on how we used it, it might be fair use.
Is it fair use if we use it for the same exact purpose?
But we wouldn't be, in this particular instance, we wouldn't be using it for the same purpose. We would be using it to discuss a song that had been used.
No, but I wanted to use it as our introduction because it goes about viewer mail. It's viewer mail time. It was a little
that
song.
That would be a harder.
There was a whole shtick.
Fair use argument, although we do have several components of the fair use argument, which is that we're focused on education. We wouldn't be making a profit. It's in the public interest, the purpose for which we're using it. Anyway, there, as we discussed in a previous podcast, there are several components to fair use, and I recommend taking a look at them. They're very interesting.
Yeah, that was my question, so I got to get my question answered.
I'll have to find one for you.
Off the cuff. Well, I just wanted that little song because Paul and Dave used to argue about it. I always want to talk about TV in these episodes. Maybe we should have a TV podcast.
It's a real problem because I really don't have that background.
You're not a lonely, sad hacker who sits all night writing tests and watching TV?
I listen to music. When I've always listened to music rather than watching TV. So, unfortunately, for all you listeners, you should know that we constantly are in this situation where Bradley is making these probably hilarious TV references, and they just fall on deaf ears.
They're not really hilarious. That's part of the problem. But they're,
They are now.
They are copious. That much I can say. But yeah, I always have TV. I've told people this. I've been telling people this for like.
Is there a TV
years.
Reference about making TV? It must be. We've had so much meta TV.
I suppose that's true. But my point is,
you're not performing on command.
No. I've told people for like 2 years that writing test coverage for free software, it's like the best hacking to do in front of the TV because it requires some concentration, but not so much. And it's a little bit boring, so it works perfectly.
And yet so important.
Test coverage. Everything should have 100% test coverage. It's mandatory. Of course, this is not a hacking podcast, so I shouldn't be talking about hacking. We should get through some
of these.
Well,
what's the first question? Bradley has the questions on his monitor, so.
You can see my monitor.
I can, but I'd have to lean over.
I'm going to drink my root beer.
All right, then I'll read the first question.
Okay.
We're going to start with this one, right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so this question is from Eric. And the question is, working in free software can be relatively thankless at times. Can you each name an occasion, case, or project you worked on where you were happily reminded, now this is why I toil in free software? And what gives you the most satisfaction in your job?
Okay.
This is a softball question.
I suppose it is. I mean, it's tough for me to answer specifically. I can describe the first one as more of a series of things that tend to happen, usually at conferences. One of the strange things about the work that I've been doing since 1999, around 2000, when I started volunteering and then working for the FSF, and then here, is that I made not actually a really conscious choice to go into this legal and policy side of free software instead of actually writing free software. And it was somewhere about halfway through my time at FSF I started to realize, I don't really do that much coding or hacking on free software. But I see a lot of it, particularly at conferences. When I go to a conference, and there's some sort of meetup of developers and they're sitting together working on free software things. And I like the fact that I can see them working on it and they don't have to think about licenses. because mm-hmm. the GPL basically takes care of the issues they need to worry about. So I'm never annoyed when developers don't know much about the GPL. I'm happy to educate them if they're interested, but they really rely on it it's readable text, but it's sort of a black box to them. They know it works. They know that it keeps their freedom and mm-hmm. in safety, and that they can work together and collaborate. And just watching developers collaborate, just seeing them. I remember specifically 1 year at GuadEC in the terminal room. This is back when you had to go to a place at a conference to connect up to the network, and going into the terminal room and the first GuadEC I went to, and seeing all the GNOME hackers working together and having that moment where they spend most of the year working remotely, when they got to sit down together and work on something. And just seeing that made it worthwhile to me and made me glad that I work on the GPL and keep the GPL strong so that they don't have mm-hmm. to worry about it.
I think there's a lot to love about our jobs. I mean, I feel like the luckiest lawyer in the world. It's such a fun job being a lawyer at SFLC. One of the things that is really, really fun is that there are a lot of lawyers that are new to our field, and they're really confused, and it's really easy to help educate people and bring them up to speed, and that's really fun. There's also so much, there's a lot of gray area on the margins. Now, we've said before that these are not, the areas in which we have legal disagreement are not the majority of what we see every day, but at the same time, in those edge cases, which are often theoretical, there's a lot to think about, and it's really fun because a lot of it is uncharted waters. So that's really fun, too.
And since I'm drinking one right now, we also get free root beer at our jobs. Free as in root beer. And it's funny because it's too many free software projects like to talk about beer, but I don't drink beer. But I do drink root beer, and we get it at no charge. You don't get many perks in a nonprofit job.
It's true.
But the one perk we have is zero-cost root beer and zero-cost coffee. And I like
coffee. We also have a flexible dress code.
Well, that's every nonprofit has that,
that's
trust me.
That's certainly true.
I've worked with many
but
people
as lawyers
who have purple
go,
hair.
Many
yeah. people.
Many people? Two.
Multiple people.
Two.
Yes.
Yeah. And I don't have purple hair. For the record.
Yeah. So I suppose the no charge root beer is sort of a glib answer to
really
job satisfaction.
I mean, I think it's just working with people who are doing wonderful things is the best job in the world.
Yeah, I mean, my real answer, my non glib answer to the most satisfaction question is really a little bit lame. Basically, I always wanted a job where I would never have to be in an ethical dilemma about proprietary software.
Mm-hmm.
And I basically ended up working for the FSF originally, now the SFLC, because I never wanted to do anything that didn't help free software. And I refused to write proprietary. I did write proprietary software very early in my career, and after that I decided I was never doing it again. So just being able to say no to anything that's not good for free software is the most important thing to me in a job, and fortunately I have that here.
Yeah, our stories are somewhat similar in a way, because when I quit working at a for-profit law firm, the reason I gave was that I wanted to work on something I cared about. Mm-hmm. So I have that too.
Yeah, I mean, yeah. I got into this primarily because of that. I mean, people want to hear this whole story, you know, find old speeches of mine on the internets, and where I talk about my history of being a proprietary software developer, a sysadmin for proprietary stuff, and realizing that that world was so horrible, basically because you didn't have the four freedoms. And for that reason, that's why I decided to dedicate my entire career to free software, because in the end, computer science is like my whole life, and I realized that if the software wasn't free as in freedom, that computer science was dead. So that's why I decided to go this way. So I could not do anything else.
I think generally I would recommend to anybody to give it a try, to work on what you really care about and work at a nonprofit.
Yeah, and just tell your employer no. Make you do something proprietary. That's smart. That's
so now I guess we've glowed about our jobs. Now I suppose we have to earn
move
our
on
keep.
To actually real questions. Yeah, other than this nice softball one Eric sent us. Eric is also a fan of the Pushing Daisies, which was canceled. To make a TV reference again, he and I chat back and forth about Pushing Daisies.
I saw most of an episode of Pushing Daisies, and
I
enjoyed
it. It's a pretty good show. It's yeah. done. It's over.
Oh, it is?
I haven't seen the last few episodes. I'm saving them until, you know, because when you watch them, they're done forever. It's gone forever. And so if the longer you wait, the longer it still exists.
Okay.
Okay. All right, let's move on. So our next question is actually, it's a really common question that gets asked in a variety of different ways. is regarding contributor agreements and assigning mm-hmm. your copyright back to projects when they ask you to. And this actually happens in two different ways. And I mm-hmm. want to clarify, this question, by the way, is from Jim. The two different ways that we see this are very different in their applications. The one way that you see it is the traditional Free Software Foundation model, where the FSF asks you to assign the copyright to them so that the copyright can be enforced by the FSF mm-hmm. and those sorts of things. And it's done in a nonprofit way. And in fact, the contributor gets a promise back that the software will always be free software and mm-hmm. various things like that.
Yeah, and also, I mean, there is an element with the FSF where if circumstances arise down the road that the current license is not responsive to, then you can relicense it under another free software license that addresses those problems.
Yeah, and I guess those are the things that I, in my biased opinion, would call the pure motives for asking for a copyright assignment.
Right, well, right, sort of the nonprofit.
Yeah.
Side of, because the FSF, like other organizations that often take copyright assignments or even require them in the FSF's case, you know, they're nonprofit organizations. They're set up to work in the public interest. So that is the mission of the organization. And not only, you know, do the people who work there want to do that, but they are obligated to continue to follow the mission of the organization. And where that mission is to promote free software, you know that your code is going to be safe there.
Yeah, but we're actually dancing around the key issue that Jim asks about, because he's
right.
clearly asking about the software company, the for-profit company that asks for an assignment, mm-hmm. usually to do what I call proprietary relicensing. Some people call it dual licensing. I encourage you not to call it that, only because there are three distinct different concepts mm-hmm. in the free software world that people use to describe, use the phrase dual licensing to describe. So I just never use that phrase for anything because it's so confusing. What we're talking about is a company that says, we're contributing this code under a free software license. If you want to patch it, you must assign the copyright back to us so that we can go and make a proprietary version in parallel, which we relicense to people who want out of the GPL. They want some other proprietary terms to the code. And there are a number of different projects that do this. It became a relatively common thing, particularly during the dot-com boom and a lot of the places that do it are mm-hmm. remnants of that. And that's a question of, is it good or bad? And Jim's asking, what are the advantages and the disadvantages? So, Karen, why don't you talk about are you willing to talk about the advantages? Because
I think it can be a little bit more organic than that.
Okay.
I mean, I think if we want to talk
about
it.
I just don't want to talk about the advantages. Okay, I'll admit their advantages. Okay. I will say that there is one advantage, which is that a lot of times the money used in the proprietary licensing gets fed back in funding developers for the GPL version. So there is that benefit to it.
Yeah, I mean, there's another benefit in, you know, in enforcement, because centralizing copyright in any organization or company allows it a little bit easier to... Bradley is looking very eager.
I'm rubbing my hands together because we're going to have a debate. I'm so excited.
Oh, I see. Okay.
I'm getting excited for a debate because
I disagree. Well, but the problem is that, well, then what I was going to say is that there's a disadvantage connected to this, which is what I think you're focusing on, I think by your eager rubbing of your hands together, which is that, you know, when you assign to a nonprofit, you know that any exercise of those rights are going to be in the public interest and for free software and to promote free software generally. But if you give that power to a company, they're going to enforce for their business interests, potentially.
Actually, it's even more than that in my view. I appreciate that your view is nuanced, and we're not going to have like a, you know, a point counterpoint debate on it. But I think that what a lot of these companies are doing is, in fact, sometimes it depends on the company, of course, but at times they're actually pushing the GPL a little bit too far. Because it suddenly becomes in their interest to have incredibly overbroad interpretations of the GPL, because they basically want almost everybody to be in violation. Why? Well, because every person who wants to do something that would be a GPL violation has to pay them for a proprietary license. So you see a lot of pressure in these companies to basically over-aggressive enforcement. They go out and enforce, quote-unquote, against people who are clearly not violating the GPL. And this was, I mean, I'm dancing around. I should just say the example. I mean, this is well known in the community that a lot of people bought proprietary licenses to MySQL that were just using the database in the traditional SQL way, which everybody in the GPL community, except for MySQL or now Sun, now Oracle, believe that that's not really a GPL violation just to use the SQL language. But they convinced many companies to buy proprietary licenses they didn't need. And I find that very unfortunate. And I think that's, when the business interest is so sort of against the community's interest in those kind of ways, it bothers me.
Yeah, I mean, I think when you're talking about assigning a copyright to a company, you have to really think about what you're selling it for. You know, what am I getting for this bargain, and is it worth my while, and what are the negative implications that could happen that I'm not aware of right now? So if you assign it, am I going to get any pledges from the company about how they're going to use that assignment, what they're going to do for enforcement, and how they might license the software down the road?
Yeah, and in fact, some companies have just mimicked the FSF copyright assignment with the promise back to always make it free software, which I think is a really good thing. And I think more companies should pick up contributors agreements. And there have been efforts here and there to try to standardize some of these contributor agreements. I mean, I think we want to help with that over time. It's a really tough process to go through, and it will take time. But I mean, getting good contributor agreements that respect the freedom of the community is a project that's ongoing for everyone.
Yeah, and one of the things that we've talked about and in previous episodes is that it makes sense for companies, you know, to respect the community, because if they do want a community to continue around the software that they're using, you know, creating this sort of monopoly over patches and a monopoly over over usage and perhaps taking the code and the licensing in a direction that the community wouldn't be happy with would kill their community. People would just go off and work on something else.
Right. And companies are sometimes short-lived. I mean, I think specifically that this is a story that like 10 people in the free software world remember, probably because it was so long ago. But Nautilus was actually developed primarily by a company called Easel, which was a company that was formed during the dot-com boom to try to make money out of free software. And like many startups, it failed. Now, fortunately, the code was all released under GPL and out there. But you can have situations where if the company has too much control of the code base, the project can't survive. And it was a little dicey for Nautilus, which, by the way, is the file manager for GNOME. Was not clear what was going to happen with it when Easel failed. And now it survived, but it was dicey, and that's something to think about. The final part of Jim's question that we should address is he asks, you know, basically what should I consider when I decide to do this? I think it really comes down to whether or not you're comfortable with the agreement and whether you think it's in the best interest of the community. And sometimes it is and sometimes it isn't. And it's such a case-by-case question that you have to ask yourself and your co-developers. And people have forked over this issue. Yeah. It's not uncommon.
Mm-hmm. And one of the things that lawyers, you know, you bring in lawyers to do is to think about what can go wrong and what the worst case scenario is. And I think that developers are often well positioned to think about the same things, because we're all worried about accounting for cases that could be any case. So think about what could be done with that assignment, and think about whether you need any parameters. What kind of assurances do you need to feel comfortable with it?
And finally, I'd say that the SFLC exists primarily to help the individual developer and nonprofit developer to contribute to free software. So if you find yourself as a developer in this dilemma where a company is asking you to assign copyright on some free software program and you're not sure, write to help at softwarefreedom.org. Mm-hmm. That's exactly what we're here for. So this is somewhat of a disjoint show because we have to jump topics very quickly. Not as smooth, but we should move on to this next question that we got from Saul. And he's asking, I think actually this was a question I thought was, I read it and I was like, yeah, this is a really good question. I think we can answer it well, but it's something important to think about. So Saul is asking, based on the show we had where we talked about the patent provisions of GPL v3 in particular, what happens when you take one of those permissively licensed works and then incorporate them through license compatibility into a GPL v3 project? And he's wondering, how does the whole patent grant stuff work when you've brought in code? And he's asking, well, does the permissive license developer, are they forced to give the patent grant from GPL v3, or what's going on there? And then if they aren't, how is it compatible? So that's a good question.
Oh yeah, I think it's a really good question.
So I think where we should start is to talk about the fact that there actually is an implicit patent grant in every free software license, even the most permissive ISC license, because you're permitting somebody to use the work in certain ways.
Exactly. You're giving permission to somebody to use the specific code for this reason or this purpose. And so along with that, there's what we call an implicit patent grant. So in other words, if you didn't give that person the patent grant, then you wouldn't be, basically it goes along with what you're transferring anyway. If you're giving permission, you also have to be giving permission for the patents to some extent.
Right. And the other point to note is that the GPL does not insist that the patent provisions of the GPL explicitly be granted by authors who didn't license under the GPL themselves. So to quote from the license, it says, a contributor is a copyright holder who authorized use under this license of a program or work on which the program is based. So it's talking about specific people who chose the license under V3.
So it's pretty narrow. So if I take Bradley's code and I make some improvements and I want to license my improvements under GPL V3, I'm the only one granting a patent grant, an explicit patent grant.
Right. And so when you think about compatibility, think primarily about contradictions, right? So there's nothing in the ISC license and the other permissive licenses that contradict the patent provisions of V3. They're just basically silent on them. Mm-hmm. I guess you could say. Am I saying that right? I should check with you.
Well, I mean, it's a fair... Oh, about the...
They're silent on patents.
Right, yeah. Exactly.
So there's nothing to say, oh, this contradicts. It can't say... For example, let's take an example of a license that might say, you are granted absolutely no patent rights with this license. Well, that would more than likely be a GPL-incompatible license because it's not silent.
Right.
It's shouting to the world, I'm explicitly not giving you patents. But if it's silent, we've got the case of the implicit patent grant, and we've also got the case that the GPL is not requiring those authors to necessarily be
to agree or to become a contributor. You're right.
Under the GPL V3 definition of contributor.
So So the person who originally distributed their work under a permissive license just gave a very broad permission. And then the next person that came along and wanted to license their improvements under GPL V3 is just using the code of the first person under those permissive terms that person had originally licensed it under. So, you know, they're just exercising the permissions that they already have. They're saying that their own improvements must be under more restrictive terms.
And their improvements, of course, are going to be contributor improvements, which have that patent claim. But the original work is still there and still under a certain license.
So if you're releasing your code under a permissive license, you don't need to worry that someone's going to come back to you and say, you granted all these explicit patent grants under GPL V3.
Quite so. And I think the other thing to note is this is an important time to remember that it's very important to leave those other permissive license notices in the code and make it clear that certain copyright holders picked different licenses. They happen to be licenses that were compatible with GPL, and therefore what you're doing is legally permissible. However, you should make it clear that the other copyright holders didn't necessarily license under GPL V3 proper.
Right. And to obey the terms under that license, you need to share those terms.
Right. And keep the copyright notices intact
exactly.
And so forth. And on this point, I will link to in the show notes and refer people to our collaboration memo about GPL V3 or GPL in general and permissively licensed works, because that talks about how to keep those things intact.
Great. Before we leave for this segment, which I think is where we're headed now.
I think so.
I do have to say that for all of these questions, if you've got a specific situation, you should seek legal advice. That we're giving sort of our view of these questions, and we're giving a discussion, but we can't give you specific legal advice for your situation over our podcast.
Karen turned into a lawyer again. Everybody watch out.
I was trying so hard to make it sound more conversational.
No, you sound like a lawyer. It's okay, because you're absolutely correct. And of course, I am not a lawyer, and everything I say is not legal advice, because I'm not licensed to give legal advice anywhere in the world. And I'm glad for that.
I guess on that note, we'll be right back.
So we were almost doing that Monty Python skit in the last section where we were arguing about whether or not we were having an argument.
We weren't having an argument.
It was an argument.
It was not an argument.
See, we're doing it again.
We'll be here all night.
No, we won't. We're almost done. We've almost answered all the pending questions.
Well, we've got a few more.
And we have a question here from Andrew. who is asking basically about the issue of using the offer for source under GPL as opposed to giving the source code along with the binaries. He's sort of wondering if, well, if he gave the binaries to someone as part of his business but didn't happen to give the source code, just made it available to them or otherwise offered the source, how do his obligations play out under GPL when somebody downstream from them distributes the binaries?
And he says, I would read from him a little bit because I think he says it very well. He says, if I were a company creating software, I would want all my customers to have all the freedoms that GPL provides, but I wouldn't necessarily want to wear the cost of things like bandwidth server load for people who aren't my customers. Wouldn't this provide less of an incentive for people to GPL their code?
Yeah, it's certainly the case that if you provide your direct customers with source code, you've fulfilled your obligations. And certainly, it's never required under GPL that you make the source code publicly available if you haven't made the binaries publicly available. You just have to make the source code available alongside the binaries when you distribute them to someone or give access to a website to someone. So it's never the case that you're required to do actions for downstream compliance, except in the case where you've used the offer for source provision, which is one of the reasons why I've always encouraged people to avoid the offer for source provision, because it does create various obligations for you to third parties and other things that you can't really predict all that well. So it's always better just to give the source directly to your customers. And if, for example, if you have a login site where your customers log into and that's where they find the binaries, just put the source code right behind the same login screen. And they log in to get the binaries, they log in to get the source code, no problems with that. Mm-hmm. And GPLv3, in fact, is very specific about allowing this. Andrew did mention GPLv2 specifically. And it is true that the GPLv2 is somewhat silent on this issue of internet distribution, in part because internet distribution was not particularly common when the GPLv2 was drafted. It was mostly the case that people got their software distributed on magnetic tape, basically, in the drafting era of V2. But it was always the interpretation of V2 that they worked this way, and V3 puts that out into black letter in the actual text of the license. So I think that's the real answer there, is just give the source code right alongside the binaries. Did you have anything you'd like to add about source code distribution alongside binaries?
I think if this seems like an overly simplistic answer, we did discuss this in length in our compliance guide.
Yep.
So it's definitely worth looking at, and in it we actually talk about the specific provisions of GPLv2 versus GPLv3 and how these play out. But I would definitely echo what Bradley said, which is that if you if you're distributing the source code along with binaries every time, then you're not going to be in that situation where you have an offer 2 years down the road and don't know, what source code corresponds to it. And it's a lot easier.
It's always easier. Offer for source is stupid. Never use it. It's there if you need it, but don't use it. So the rest of Andrew's question is about my favorite license, the Affero GPL.
It's no secret what your favorite license is.
What's my favorite license? The Affero GPL. Karen's playing with her open MoCo and not listening to me talk about that.
I am playing with my open MoCo, which I do really like. But I'm still...
Your phone technology is more freeze and freedom than mine.
It's true. Does that intimidate you?
It doesn't intimidate me. It makes me feel a little stupid. Hmm. And I have to use this argument that I still use this phone because it's environmentally sound to use the phone until it breaks.
Well, I think, the OpenMoCo, I think, is not necessarily the ideal solution. But it works great for me. I've been really liking it.
I'm glad. I wish that it wasn't so hard to use, but they'll get it better, I'm sure. But now we're off topic. We should answer Andrew's Affero GPL question and stop answering our SMS messages on our OpenMoCos. Not to single anyone out. Of course, there's only one person in the room who happened to have an OpenMoCo in her hand. And there's also
I'm often the only person in the room to have an OpenMoCo in my hand. In fact, when I went to the BASA conference, I was the only... I was in Brazil, which was free software people working on mobile phones. I was the only one with an OpenMoCo.
That's scary. And you saw Howard Velta there, right? He worked on the Open Book when he didn't have one.
Yeah, but he was interested to see that I had one.
I'm sure he was, given he worked on it. So let's get back to Andrew's question about my favorite license. So he's concerned, actually the funny thing is, his question is a question we used to get a lot about the regular old GPL, which is regard to the images, logos, and other types of content you might have on a website that are not necessarily the software. And how does the AGPL interact with that stuff? Well, in fact, it actually doesn't, by and large. Mm-hmm. The best example of the logo issue and the branding issue is to look at the situation with Red Hat's various distributions over the years. And in fact, people understood that they had to remove the Red Hat trademarks from redistributed versions, because even though you have the rights on the GPL, that doesn't give you a license to the trademarks that happen to be in place at various places in the system. You know, big distribution, there's .png files that have images of the trademarks and so forth, and those aren't necessarily licensed under GPL, and there's also the area of trademark that's covering
right,
them.
We've talked about trademarks a little bit in the past, in previous episodes, but the crux behind trademark law is that you can't use the image if it's going to confuse people about who is distributing the software. So it's basically, it's a branding issue. Will consumers be confused? And therefore you can't keep a brand name on something if you're not the company that is associated with the brand.
Right. And I think going back to the point that inspired Andrew to ask is that the Affero GPL works very well in this case, because you won't have to worry about somebody who takes the Affero code and makes a competing web service. They won't have a license to your trademarks, and and they will have to use different branding, and they will have to build their own brand up using the same code base, which they have to provide the source code to all their users, which means you can become a user and get access to it and so forth. So
yeah, that said, we've talked about fair use in previous episodes as well. There is sort of an analogy for fair use under trademark law. So there are instances where you can use trademarks. You're looking at me like, this is very off topic, I guess.
No, it's a good example. It's a good example, because the classic example I was given is GNU's not Unix. Because that uses the Unix trademark, but it clearly says that GNU is not Unix.
Right. It's factual. There's no confusion.
Right. It's the opposite of confusion.
Exactly.
You know,
exactly. Exactly.
So yeah, so that's a case where they could say, our service is not your service.
Right.
So that could happen, but it will be clear they can't sort of leapfrog off your trademarks to build their own brand, which is really what you care about, I think, in that situation. So I think the Affero GPL works great. You should use it for all your projects. We need more free web services. See Autonomous website for more. So we have our next question is from Christian, who asks, and I don't know, since Christian is a bi-gender name, I will say Christian and not give gender. Is asking about the Creative Commons licenses, and points out that there's some that are not for non-commercial use and no derivative works and so forth, and asks about the analogy to software. How come we don't have software licenses that are all the different myriad of types of restrictions you could have in the Creative Commons space?
Right. He or she is basically asking, you know, the Creative Commons has a whole suite of licenses. What about the GPL?
Well, I'd start by saying the GPL does have a suite of licenses. We have the LGPL, the GPL, the Affero GPL, the GPL plus various different exceptions. Mm-hmm. So that's a suite.
It absolutely is. And I think that is part of the answer, is that, you know, where there's a need for different circumstances, you know, the FSF has issued other licenses to fill different purposes. But Creative Commons is actually trying to accomplish something different than the FSF is. And this is where, you know, when we're leading up to the call, I shocked Bradley by saying, you know, well, a lot of the Creative Commons licenses aren't free. And he was shocked not by what I was saying, but by my bluntness.
Because you sounded like RMS.
Well, I mean, but he's right. But it's those licenses are trying to accomplish a different purpose.
Right.
So Creative Commons is also is designed to deal with other kinds of media that are distributed, that are copyrightable. So it's trying to deal with situations for distributing photographs and music and a whole host of copyrighted works, and a lot of the people who want to use the Creative Commons licenses want to share a little, but don't necessarily want to share in a way that we would consider free.
And not only that, we've always said in the free software world that we're talking specifically about the issues of software and the copyleft and granting the four freedoms is really essential for the advancement of software. And different types of work need different types of permissions.
Right.
And I've typically said, because I'm such a software guy, I always say, well, I understand what rights must happen and must be available for software because I understand that field of endeavor so well.
And
but
also,
I don't really want to opine on what should be for these other types of works. And,
right.
and that's actually,
right.
I see Creative Commons almost as an experimental organization investigating the idea of what's the right license for these other types of work. What does the community want for these other types of non-software works?
And for software to be used and improved, it's essential to have that freedom so that the software can continue to be used and improved.
Mm-hmm.
That's part of what's part and parcel of the ideology behind free software. Whereas Creative Commons has sort of a different ideological mission, and that's to increase the commons of copyrighted works that are available to be looked at and to be used for different purposes, and to allow people the tools to specifically license their works under the terms that they want to. So you know, some of the licenses are quite restrictive, and some are not. Some are very close to all rights reserved, and some are fully free. So you can get a free license from Creative Commons, and you can also get specific licenses that accomplish different purposes that may or may not be free.
And we should also point out that Creative Commons itself says, when you go into the realm of software,
mm-hmm.
that the only right license is the GPL.
Mm-hmm.
Which, in fact, they're, as I understand their position, if I'm mistaken, somebody write in and tell me. But as I understand Creative Commons positions, they're actually more radical than the FSF, because they say the only thing that's good for software is GPL, but for all these other types of works, we have this myriad of licenses. So.
I don't know that they're actually come out that strongly.
They did it at one point. Maybe they backed down from that. I know they did at one point. Well, I don't know that. I'm pretty sure they did. Karen's now like getting on the internet and checking to see if I'm right. Okay. If I am wrong, the good thing about doing a podcast, you know, theoretically we could like pause right now and re-record this so that I didn't say something that might have been wrong.
We didn't do that to Dan, our producer.
And it's good to see people as fallible, as people who might make mistakes and misremember something. I think that's a good thing in the world.
But not something to strive for.
I wasn't striving for it. I was just remembering when Creative Commons, this is years ago now, took their first position on software licenses, and they picked the GPL as being the example. Certainly, I'll back down a little bit and say certainly they strongly recommend.
Yeah, we do not recommend that you apply a Creative Commons license to software code.
Correct. And I think that they basically recommend strongly that you use the GPL for all software. It may be not the case that they say it's the only license you should use, but they strongly recommend you use the GPL. How about that? That's certainly true. Karen, you still not agree with me?
I'm wondering if they actually do. Okay. They do, well, they do link to the Free Software Foundation and the OSI.
Right. So they recommend open source and or free software license.
Right.
So they certainly do that. But they prefer the GPL.
Yeah,
I'm
they do.
Sure.
Well, they do.
I see those examples
that include many of the licenses in the GNU suite of licenses,
right.
But they also refer to BSD, which is a little funny, actually.
Yeah, but I think the point is clear that the Creative Commons guys even say when you're doing software, you should use an open source and free software
mm-hmm.
license.
A license that's specifically designed for software.
Right, and it is that way. They don't recommend you use a proprietary software license. So, I think we've well answered Christian's question that do not use non-commercial licenses for software. Make licenses that give everyone freedom
mm-hmm.
to copy, share, modify, and redistribute the software.
And also
adapt
think
it
about
for their needs.
Copy, modifying, and sharing your images and art.
You should think about
as
it.
As a
it's
separate
true.
Issue.
I don't think it's a I see free software as like a fundamental mandate. It's the only way that's right to do software. I don't really know for photos. I would have to ask a photographer. What do you think?
Well, I distribute all of my photos under under a very permissive license. I have attribution only
mm-hmm.
as my Creative Commons license for my photos. And except for photos, and this was pointed out to me by Fred Van Lohman of VFF a couple of years ago, which is that that there's some confusion because where there may be publicity rights connected to a photo, this is too detailed,
mm-hmm.
You may not have permission to grant that use. And so anytime I have a photo of a friend who I'm not certain how they would care about their image being distributed, I actually revert back to all rights reserved simply on those photos, not from a copyright perspective, but because I don't want someone misunderstanding my licensing and thinking that I have granted them full permission to use that photo for any purpose.
That's That's very interesting to me. I hope it's interesting to the listeners.
Yeah, but it's a little geeky.
It is detailed licensed geekiness, but that's what we're into. So, hey, the people are listening to hear some of that. So, hey, we give them some. Christian's second question was with regards to licensing those types of works, photos, paintings, books, mm-hmm. under the GPL, and does that make sense? Well, generally, if you can't tell what the source code is or the complete and corresponding source code is of a work, it's really dangerous to license it under
GPL. It's really confusing, and it doesn't make a lot of sense.
Right. You've got to, if you look at a work and you don't immediately know what the complete and corresponding source code ought to be, and you don't have a thing called a source code and a thing called a binary executable, GPL is not the license for you.
Yeah.
It's only
for that stuff. I think if you're trying to accomplish something like a copyleft for non-software works, you might want to think about a Creative Commons share and share alike.
Yeah.
And if you want to distribute under a permissive or BSD style license, you probably want to use attribution only.
Yep. Okay, so that answers Christian's question, and we're got down to our final question here.
Oh, great.
And this is with regards to issues of the warranty disclaimer provision.
Oh, right.
It's a bug not me on Identica asked if we could talk a little bit about how projects can let people know about the warranty disclaimer and so forth. And it's, I think it's an important issue because it's very important for developers to be able to say warranties are not available for a software that you distribute freely on the internet under a mm-hmm. free software license. Because obviously a developer submitting a patch doesn't want it to be in a scenario where they have a warranty. Of course, companies go into business selling warranties for a fee, which is
right.
a great business model, mm-hmm. but the individual developer contributing does not want to be granting a warranty. And he's concerned about how do you let your users know that.
And warranties is one of those situations where it's sort of a trap for the unwary. And it's something that has been largely addressed in a lot of the very popular free software licenses. So if you look at the at the GPL or the ISC, if you look at the licenses in most popular usage, you'll see that they all have disclaimers of warranties. Now, you may not be able to disclaim all of your warranties under law, but you can disclaim a lot of them. So you do want to make sure that your license does have some disclaimer of warranties. I think the more critical point here, and there's some more complicated analysis here that talks about the nature of free software licenses and whether they're licenses and permissions only or if they're also contracts and what kind of what kind of formalities are necessary and what we have and how it's going to be analyzed. But I think what it really comes down to is if you're very clear with your customers and your customers understand what it is that your users, what you're giving to them, and if you know of bugs that you disclose them, and that if you're selling services and if you're selling software, that you let people know really what they're getting, what they can expect, and that way you'll avoid the confusion. If you're very clear, then they'll expect what you promise them and nothing more.
The only thing I would add to that is take a look at the way a lot of the GNU programs work, because the GNU programs frequently display at startup that there's no warranty and make it really clear mm-hmm. and put it in as many places as possible. And that's something the GNU project did early because they were concerned about this issue to make sure developers were protected. And if you're writing a software that's not GNU and you're starting from scratch, whatever, look at how they do it, how they display the disclaimer of warranty frequently. Emacs, when it starts up, shows it to you right away.
I would be particularly careful if you're giving software to someone for a particular purpose and there's a bug that prevents the use in that way. Mm-hmm. So really worry about those kinds of situations. And I hate to be all lawyerly again, but if you've got a specific question about warranties and how it works with your business or how it works with what software you want to distribute, mm-hmm. even on a, in a volunteer way, definitely you can email us at help@, and you can ask another lawyer.
So if you're a nonprofit guy, email us or gal. Email us at help@, mm-hmm. and if you're for-profit, you have to find your
definitely
lawyer.
Consult with a lawyer. It's easier to be careful about this, but you can avoid almost all of your troubles by being very clear with your users and your customers about what you're providing and what you're not.
Well, Karen, I hate to cut us off here, but we are getting attacked in our internal IRC channel. Just to give our listeners a little insight into how this podcast gets recorded, we are in Karen's office, which is off the kitchen, And we put a sign on her door saying, nobody make noise in the kitchen while we're recording the podcast. And there are apparently three people in line to use do stuff in the
to
kitchen.
To use the coffee maker.
to make noise in the kitchen. And they're yelling at us. If you heard my computer speaking aloud somewhere in the middle there, that was one of our colleagues yelling at me on IRC, which when I'm addressed on IRC, it plays out loud, telling us to get off the podcast and let them make coffee.
So we'll let them make coffee. We'll make ourselves coffee. I recommend coffee that if you like coffee, you make yourself coffee.
And email your questions to podcast@softwarefreedom.org. I'm telling them in IRC now, they can come in. The Software Freedom Law Show is produced by Dan Lynch of halfbakedmedia.com. Thanks to Mike Tarantino for our theme music. This show is released under the terms of the Creative Commons Attribution, No Derivative Works 3.0 United States license.
I do have a TV reference here.
What's that?
I'll have a twist of lemon.
I don't even get it. Hear them making the coffee? It's so crazy.